It's great to not forget about the ones that didn't work. I think what you've tried, should be I think it's great to be rigorous about measuring the results of everything that you try. So of course it would include things that didn't work. And for those that didn't work, it'd be good to try and understand why it didn't work and also be able to share that out with people or so that people can also, as your peers in other markets can also avoid making similar mistakes down the line or understand sort of like the potential pitfalls of a similar idea that they might be going after.
Welcome to a new episode of the Unicorn Bakery. My name is Fabian and today's guest is Cleo Shum. Cleo joined Uber China in 2014 as a general manager for Guangzhou, building the local and regional business. Cleo later became the EMEA director of operations, leading the platformization of the ride-sharing business across 45 countries. Most recently, Cleo was the COO at Spotahome, a Series B PropTech startup backed by Kleiner Perkins, leading the sales, operations, strategy, and marketing functions. And for nearly 2 years, Cleo is now a partner at Stride VC, a London-based venture capital firm. I'm super excited to have you on the show and to talk about operational excellence. What does it mean? How does it differ when you have the investors' hat versus the operators' hat? So therefore, welcome on the show, Cleo.
Thanks for having me, Fabian. Super excited to be here.
Let's go a bit back in the story just to make sure that everybody understands how you ended up in venture. When did you start thinking about startups? What was the first intersection of, I want to be a part of this ecosystem?
I probably started thinking about entrepreneurship back at university. When I went to Rice University in the US, I hadn't started a company back then, but after I graduated in 07, I joined McKinsey & Company as a consultant, as a lot of maybe slightly clueless people would do, trying to learn as much as I could about the business world. And fortunately or unfortunately, the financial crisis hit in 2008. And at the time, many of us were encouraged to take unpaid leave from the firm. And so I had taken the opportunity to take time off to work on a couple of startup projects with my friends, from beer distribution to trying to build a website business with my college classmate, and really enjoyed it. And then later on, when I went to business school at Wharton, I started my third project, which was called Ninja Rooms. It was a hotel tonight for Asia type of app. Again, first time building a product, really enjoyed the process. And so I'd say, the startup world, entrepreneurship was always at the back of my mind. And when I joined Uber in 2014, that was probably the first time I really fully dedicate myself to a project.
You mentioned that you were in university in the US, and then at some point you joined Uber China. What made you join Uber in China instead of like trying to be part of the US business?
Right. No, at the time, I guess I grew up in Hong Kong. So after I went to business school, I moved back to Hong Kong to work as a proprietary trader, actually at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. I'd always been interested in investing, and initially that interest was in stock investing. And so I joined the prop desk, running a book, Global Equities, Long Short Strategy. Learned a lot about that, but then at the same time, after a year of doing that, I realized it wasn't where my real passion was. I couldn't really see myself doing that for the next 10 years, and so I thought about the startup world again. And luckily, at around I think the early part of 2014, Uber was really going into China. They had launched Shanghai and they were running recruitment efforts in Asia, looking for general managers in Hong Kong and in China. So a few friends of mine had told me about it. And so I applied for the general manager role for Hong Kong. And that role was eventually given to somebody else who was already part of the company. But then, the Uber folks asked me whether I'd consider China. And I thought, well, I speak the languages. I've never really lived there, but given, it's not too far away from Hong Kong, it's a much bigger market, I decided to give it a shot. And so between Shenzhen and Guangzhou, I ended up in Guangzhou, which was, Cantonese speaking, but also Mandarin speaking, and a very, very large market to build a business in.
That's super interesting and makes total sense. Let me ask about the state of Uber when you joined versus when you left, just so people understand what kind of transformation you made as a part of Uber. Like how was the company structured and how far was it entering the Chinese market already when you joined versus how was the operation and everywhere, let's put it that way, what was the transition until you left?
Sure. So Uber had been founded for about 6 years by the time I joined in 2014, but I believe it spent its first 2 years just building the initial operations in San Francisco. And then Uber then expanded to New York. And eventually after that, I believe it was London, Singapore, Amsterdam. These were some of the earliest international expansion markets. But as the company started launching more markets, they got better at it. And so by the time I joined, Uber was present in about 29, I believe it was 29 cities globally, about 1,000 employees. And in China, we had just opened two cities and it was about 20 employees in China back then. So I was the third GM to join in China. Basically, China functioned as its own startup. It was run in a very autonomous manner, and the team was built locally. And so it felt like a brand new startup on the ground, despite being part of a larger mothership. And by the time, and it's, I guess, interesting to note that when I joined, we hadn't yet launched Uber Eats or Jump, the bike sharing business, or Uber Freight, or a lot of these experiments or projects hadn't yet been launched. It was purely a ride sharing platform. And by the time I left in November 2018, so about 2.5 years later, Uber was in, I believe, 600 cities or so around the world, over 100 countries, and about 25,000 employees. So the company had gotten a lot bigger just during the span of those 4.5 years.
That's super crazy from when we look at it from like how fast the company was growing. And I think for everybody to understand this, we were talking about like a few dozen cities when you joined, and a few years later, like over 1,000 cities, which is like a huge increase, which I would call exponential growth. And a lot of founders might think, oh, after 6 years, Uber was already in 1,000 cities, which they weren't. We could hear it right now. So take your time, build the fundamentals, and then try to scale fast, which is a super interesting insight, like that you just mentioned in a sentence I wanted to highlight. But also, you then later on worked in London at Spotahome, and I would love to compare a bit the differences between running operations in China versus in Europe, because I think it's super hard for a lot of European founders or also US founders to understand the differences of a Chinese market and Asia compared to Europe or the US. So from your experience, what are the largest differences or specifics that you need to look and watch out for if you're building business in Asia?
For sure. So Asia, in some ways similar to Europe, is that it's multilingual, it is fragmented from a country borders perspective, language perspective, and regulatory perspective, except that the regulatory frameworks are less mature in Asia, so it has a bit more of a Wild West sort of feel to it. And I guess, average GDP per capita tends to be lower, but then the populations are high across a number of countries, right? Like the Philippines or Indonesia. And so it is a very kind of exciting, emerging region. In terms of the difference between, when I think about U.S. companies that try to expand in Europe or Asia, but let's take Europe as an example, I think a lot of U.S. HQ'd companies or employees often don't understand or empathize the complexities of building in a region like Europe or Asia. So when we ran Uber EMEA, which was essentially all the markets outside of the Americas and Asia, so 45 countries spanning Scandinavia to Russia, Pakistan to all of Africa, and of course, Western Europe. So a region of 33 languages and many different sets of regulations. And so in rolling out a new country or new products, you can't really just copy and paste what works in the US into these markets, right? And there are always additional steps like translations, like legal checks, or different payment providers that you need to integrate with, like M-Pesa, right, for Kenya, for example, to really serve the markets, the local markets properly. And so product launches or rollout, launching businesses as well in different markets need to be a bit more considered, and as a result might take a little bit longer. And sometimes in terms of very American type of mindset, people didn't always understand that. And there's also a difference but if you think about Asia again, which was your original question, I think the work-life boundaries tend to be different in that they tend to be a lot more integrated with, so work and life tend to be integrated a lot more. And taking China specifically, which is quite unique as a market, if you look at how people work, basically WeChat is where you do all your business messaging, internal team messaging often, PR, marketing, Sometimes even customer support. So, and it's also where you can do ride hailing. And so when everything is sort of in this one app, and where culturally people often blend business and pleasure and social, then, you know, people just kind of are working on like longer hours and more and more time over the weekends and over what we call personal time as well, right? So in China, there's this common way of working called 996. You might have heard of it, right? Which is like working from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week. And this was extremely common in China tech, probably still is. And when we were at Uber in China, we worked, yeah, pretty much every day of the week because the business was just running and everyone did so. And so it was a very, very high paced environment. And we often, in terms of execution, we executed on ideas the same day that we came up with them. And we weren't like, hey, let's do it next week or the week after, or let's plan for it. We're like, let's do it now. And so China and Asia, I would say, were both really competitive regions where, you know, consumers tended to be quite sensitive to promotions. And we had, you know, well-funded companies. Nowadays, the venture landscape is maturing. And China's definitely got a very mature landscape already. But Asia is also, you know, maturing. But in the ride-sharing space where we were operating at the time, both these regions have very well-funded competitors, right? Didi and Grab. And so, you know, while Europe also had competition, because regulatory barriers were higher, once you've managed to scale in Europe, you can actually have better profitability. And it was harder for the landscape to get crowded. And then when you think about sort of Europe, you know, we also have a lot more employment protections here in terms of how, you know, whether you can or how you make redundancies or how you think through sort of like gig worker rights and benefits. You know, Europe is often quite forward thinking and quite protective in those regards. And so that's also quite different when you think about how that would impact your hiring, your firing, and also the costs, you know, that it takes to run your business. Yeah. And maybe one last example in terms of the regulatory landscape and the mindset that it takes to work in these markets. I guess there's definitely a mindset difference between Europe and the US. I think a classic example is when Uber rolled out Uber Pop in Europe, which is basically the European version of the P2P ride-sharing service that we had in the US. At the time, it was done in the US way. So, you know, we didn't ask for permission, which led to a lot of friction with regulators and with taxi companies and led to many markets, authorities asking for Uber Pop to be shut down across Europe. And Uber later had to adjust its approach in rolling out jump bikes, you know, in a way that was collaborative with regulators in Europe, which was an approach that served them a lot better. So these are some of the areas, I guess, in which the various regions are different, right? There's regulatory landscape, there's definitely, you know, competition, work-life boundaries, and yeah, like just the complexities it takes to work in sort of multilingual environment as well.
I think that's super important to know for everyone thinking about starting operations in Asia. I think one central question here: do I need a local person to run my operations in China, or can I, let's say, hey, this is person A, he or she was employee number 5 in our company, happy to move to China and start operations there and build it from zero, but originally from the US and had no touch points with Asia or China in specific before?
Yeah, I would definitely go with the first approach, which is hiring a local team. I think China is very much a go big or go home type of market. It's just completely different from the US, right? In terms of how people work, you know, the culture there, but also the platforms that you're used to using, you know, with the Great Firewall, a lot of the tools that you normally use simply wouldn't work there, like Google, Facebook, you know, Instagram, Twitter. China has their own versions of all of those. And so just navigating your way around the market, knowing how to establish your brand, but maybe more importantly, dealing with regulators and government relations, which is a very large part of doing business in China. I don't think you can just, you know, move an expat over to just learn about the markets while they're on the ground. I mean, I guess somebody could localize, but I think it would probably take at least 5 to 10 years for somebody to fully localize and not operate at a disadvantage to someone who's native, like who's from China. And so I think the best approach would, you know, always in my mind be to recruit a team locally. And you can always, you know, have one of your early employees spearhead the effort. But definitely, I think it's important to hire people who understand how to operate in the landscape of China, but also can be empowered to make decisions and also try out various tactics, right? Operational tactics or marketing messaging in ways that communicate with the customer effectively.
Can we quickly define one thing that I mentioned in the beginning, but I think is super important to put in here now? It's how do you define operational excellence? That was the word that I was looking for. After all the experience that we talked about with Uber, but also with Spot a Home that we will cover in a second, what is your definition of operational excellence?
Yeah, so operations is such a broad term. It's, in my mind, it's really 360, kind of from start to finish, from when you bring talent in through the door to how you put them in a great cultural environment. And then there's the infrastructure that supports, how they work day to day. And then there's also the execution part, right? And I might just maybe walk through a few of these, key areas, which I would generally think through when it comes to operating. So first is like the talent piece, right? So bringing in great talent that, has an amazing trajectory in terms of learning, but also culture fit, right? With the way that's like in a way that fits in with an entrepreneurial environment, and managing to keep that bar really high and keep it constantly high, and maybe constantly raising the bar as you scale, which a lot of companies have struggled to do, but also the great ones generally manage to do that quite well. So talent density is a concept I'd like to sort of think of and be really rigorous about to maintain at all times and try and increase it. And it includes being honest about letting people go when they're not keeping up with the growth of the company and the growth of their role. Because in startups, typically, your role could change every 6 months, and that's quite normal. And finding people who act like owners of the company versus employees, right? And that's a real mindset sort of thing that really benefits a company at the early stage. So talent, just one, how do you bring in, hire great talent in the beginning, but also keep the bar really high and then continue to do that at scale? And then there's the culture piece. I think people are generally drawn to startups because it's an environment where it's more simple. There's ideally no politics. It's, people have a bias towards action and, creating an environment of continuous learning and playbooking. I think in Uber, we did a lot of playbooking where whenever you experiment and it goes well, we try out a new tactic and it went well. We often, measure the results, but then immediately playbook it and share it with operators in different markets so that the learning curve for the next market or the next team can just be steeper and people can get up the curve faster. And so operations can continuously get better because of this continuous learning loop and playbooking and sharing. This includes obviously being data-driven and being fact-based and being honest about what worked and what didn't and constantly testing. And so in terms of thinking through the culture, I think ideally you have a place that encourages that sort of mindset of entrepreneurialism, creativity, execution, and being willing to take risks and throw things at the wall and see what works and what doesn't, sort of in the early days. And keeping the environment quite pure and simple, the lack of politics and giving people the right to execute, take ownership, I think is a really great thing that I've seen. And then there's the infrastructure piece, right? There's I think there was a piece of magic about Uber that we all took for granted at the time. But whenever I meet with alums and we talk about how it's been working at other startups or what we would like to see at other startups, is the fact that we had automated and transparent data across the business. So the metrics were constantly updated, real time, globally, invisible to everyone, and everyone was looking at the same dashboard. And so it was really a joy for everyone who was executing and experimenting because you get that instant feedback. And most importantly, because we're sharing the same dashboard and the same set of metrics, everyone was focused on the same North Star metrics. And so that infrastructure actually, hard to come by, as we later learned. And it was set up in a way that is extremely scalable across all markets. And markets, everybody in their own market can just see what was happening in their own city, but also see what was happening in other cities. And we can see even a leaderboard that compared every city against each other in a sort of healthy, competitive sort of way, which made it quite fun and interesting. And then there's, thinking through sort of after infrastructure, you think about how you actually operate, right? Like how people do work and what do they focus on. And I think focus is really a key in startup. Operating in a resource constrained situation, you have limited cash, you have limited people, and so the number of things you can be doing ideally should be quite restricted and few, right? So focus and alignment is key. You shouldn't have too many priorities. And I think the way you set your priorities is, I guess, it's up to you. I mean, many people talk about using OKRs. You can choose to use OKRs or some other system, but I think the key is really to be super clear on what the priorities are across the company and how they're measured, and just not having too many of them, right? I think generally, like, four big priorities should be enough. I mean, there's no hard rules here, but I'm just thinking like 3 to 5, you're generally a number or a fair, a small number that people can remember. And people should ideally understand how their own personal priorities and KPIs roll up and contribute to the team level and then to the company level. And more importantly, why the priorities are what they are. And I think once people understand the why, and there's, you know, very few, you know, priorities, they can really be focused and just execute. So I think just focusing on not too many things, and ideally few things, is best. And often in my one-on-ones with direct reports, back when I was operating, it was about looking at sort of the list of priorities that folks had and discussing them together, but oftentimes just crossing out quite a few of them to make sure we're not spreading ourselves too thin. And then there's clear ownership and accountability, which I think is covered in, you know, the point that I just mentioned. If everyone individually knows what their own priorities and KPIs are and what they are sort of personally responsible for, then there should be, you know, ownership and accountability that naturally comes as you set up your cadence to regularly check in with each other, which is actually my next point. In operating, I think it's important to be thoughtful about your operating and communication cadences. It sounds quite tactical, but then these have to be evolved from when you're, you know, I was running a team of 3 when I first started in Uber China, and then 15, and then 50, and then eventually Spotahome is 100 plus. So it's, you know, how do these cadences get adjusted, right? So that the objective is making sure that the teams are in sync and in the most efficient ways possible. So everyone has the information they need, but at the same time, not spending too much time getting that information and just on coordinating with each other. So that means every few months I would adjust the cadences, but also oftentimes when your teams are big enough, deliberately creating these cross-functional collaboration structures. I used to call them strike teams, but really to ensure that the functions are not siloed and each doing their own thing. Like marketing's doing their own thing, product's doing their own thing, ops doing their own thing. Like they shouldn't be siloed in that sense, but that you have teams collaborating across functions and all oriented towards, kind of grouped in working groups around the most important priorities. And so to go into the strike team kind of concept a bit more, it's kind of like product squads, but it usually includes operations, marketing, customer support, besides also product and tech. So again, the idea is to break the functional silos to create focus and also collaboration across the most important initiatives. And again, there shouldn't be too many. We did this in our team. I remember this most when we were, you know, at Uber EMEA, trying to platformize and automate operations across the 45 countries, which are all very fragmented and different from each other. But this is the way in which we managed to centralize a lot of initiatives effectively over a short period of time with limited resources. And then the last piece is probably the mindset. I think, you know, there are definitely CEOs who are great storytellers and visionaries. And obviously some of the best CEOs in the world are great storytellers and visionaries. And obviously who are also really gritty people who created something out of nothing from day one. And then sometimes the pitfall here is that they may only focus on the what, right? Like, what is the vision at the end of the day? What results do we want to show the board? What growth do we want to see? What products do we want to ship? But then not dedicating nearly enough thought on the how. And I think maybe this isn't all about the CEO or the founder whose job maybe, you know, is to be the visionary and the inspiring person. And maybe this is where a COO could really help. But regardless of who does it, I think over-focusing on the what could sometimes, you know, mean that you neglect putting in strong foundations in terms of how you operate, you know, the processes that get you to great results eventually, and sometimes even, you know, the great talent that you need in place, right? And making sure people are working together effectively. So I find the way I look at it is, I think if we focus on excellence in terms of the how, for example, starting with hiring the right people, you know, by assessing them properly, right? And providing the right environment where they are empowered. So setting the right culture, at least what's right for your company, giving people ownership clearly, and then enabling people to unleash their creativity and their energy. And then if you can kind of focus on the how in these aspects, then yeah, I think magic can happen, and then the results would naturally follow. When I think back to Uber Guangzhou, where that was you know, when we built the city to become the first city to reach 1 million weekly trips globally at Uber, and it was the largest city by volume at Uber for a while, we scaled super fast in an extremely competitive environment, because not only was there, you know, great product market fit, which is important, but also because we had our teams, you know, both the marketing side and the operational side, delivering excellence, right? Everyone was testing lots of ideas, executing really fast, pushing hard, and like rowing in the same direction and scaling. And so, and then in terms of the ultimate KPI, which we looked at the time, was trips, you know, how many weekly trips do you complete? The trips that you get at the end are really the result that came out of it and was largely like out of our control. But our job there was really to make sure we were excellent in the how.
Super interesting, and a lot of details here that we can dive into. I have a lot of or a few nitty-gritty questions to go back to them. Let's first talk about playbooking, because I think it sounds always like we have this one book and it's like super amazing, everything is in there. But what's the scrappiest version of a playbook that I start when I'm starting experiments in a team of 2, team of 5, team of 10? How do I start with the playbook and not only think about a fancy, super amazing, crazy document that has everything you would need?
Sure. At the most micro and scrappy level, it was simply one page. It could be sort of, how do you run when you're launching in a new city? How do you run, like, it captures basically one marketing campaign that you would do. Right. For example, we experimented with a viral video one time. This is the Uber China days again. But what we did, so it's basically one page that captured the initiative and the result. See, what were you trying to do? What did we do? And what were the numbers that came out of it? Like, how many users were acquired? How many views did the video get? And ultimately, like, yeah, signups and trips. Where that specific promo code was applied. So basically, it was just one page and very, very limited documentation, but it was enough for the idea to be captured and share out. Right? So we're like, okay, what we did was we took a, you know, mobile phone, very scrappily filmed a video of a couple who were arguing on the street. And the couple, it was staged, but the couple was arguing, the man was accusing his girlfriend for being a gold digger and asking him to request an Uber Black every time they went out. And it was a very kind of like, it wasn't a very meaningful conversation, but it was a bit trashy, but it was filmed in a very grainy sort of way. We uploaded it onto the Youku, which is the YouTube of China, and that went viral because a lot of people were speculating whether or not it was an ad, because the name Uber was mentioned a few times. And that, I think, eventually had about 6 million views in the space of a week, very, very low budget. And so that was something, so you're like, okay, this initiative like worked out, right? And from 6 million views, you get loads of signups, you get like incremental growth over the week over week, which you can sort of attribute to the video. But what we ended up playbooking in that instance was really the concept and the results that came out of it. And then so this is like at this most simple form. And then we just like send it out to people like, hey, here's a link of what we did recently. And this is kind of like the playbook if you want to replicate something or take the idea and do something different in your market, like go for it, right? So that was, and we used to have these sharing sessions every week. So it was not just the playbook itself, but it was a culture of sharing and playbooking, where every week the marketing managers would spend half an hour on a call with each other, everyone just running through, this is what I did, this is what we learned, this is what I did, this is what we learned. And they'll ask each other questions and learn. So there's that sort of communication around it and that culture of playbooking, which also matters. And then you can go into the more complex forms of playbooks, which are more about launching a new market, right? So in that instance, it was like, okay, how do you launch a new market in 3 weeks or even 2 weeks? There's a list of things you need to do, right? Like green lighting markets, looking at sizing, regulatory barriers, et cetera, opportunity size, and then figuring out sort of whether you have getting the right relationships to make sure you can onboard enough drivers on day one, or partnering with enough people in the media world to get the word out on day one. So there's a list of things you need to do. And then often an order and timeline in which these things need to be accomplished in order for the launch to happen. So this is a bit more involved, and there may be more details around how each task is done. But the important thing is, whenever somebody's out trying to launch a market, they can refer back to this playbook to make sure, you know, they've got all the key points addressed and it can be as smooth as possible and really get it done in a matter of 2 or 3 weeks.
I think it's also super important what you mentioned between the lines, that a playbook is not a must do. It's an if you want to, you can do. When we look at, for example, the marketing campaign, which might be different if you're focusing on a market launch, which has to follow strict rules to understand if the sizing is correct, if the market is valid, if I have the ability to launch. So therefore also understanding when something, or mentioning and like really lining out when something is mandatory and when something is an inspiration for another market or another country or another department.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the reason why I also use that one pager as an example is really to illustrate the point that the barrier to doing this should be very, very low, so that people don't look at it as a giant like task on their to-do list, because that means it won't get done. Usually that becomes a bit of an overwhelming task, right? So if you say, hey, actually, it only needs to be a page, it doesn't need to be pretty. You know, you just need to write down what worked and why it worked, why it didn't, and then share it out, and that's all it takes. If you lower the barriers to doing so, then it's easier for people to then develop that muscle memory and that habit, and then of actually naturally documenting things. And over time, that accumulates into like a great, you know, almost like a book, right, of tactics that people have tried collectively across the company. And then my second point around communicating is also, you know, when people share out these playbooks, I remember there was this great sense of like excitement and joy. It was like, oh yeah, I tried this. And then like other people may ask questions, or they'd be like, oh, that's so cool. Like, great job. You know, so people get to talk about it with their peers and they get more sort of more feedback that way. And it gives people quite a good vibe, right? It's collaborative. And so making sure that those structures are in place to enable that to happen would also mean that people are naturally then incentivized to keep doing it and sharing with each other, because it's a very positive, reinforcing type of behavior.
One other question is, do I also include what doesn't work so that I don't make the same mistake again? Or is it also sometimes good that people try different things again and again from different angles?
Yeah, I think it's great to not forget about the ones that didn't work. I think what you've tried, you know, should be... I think it's great to be rigorous about measuring the results of everything that you try. So of course it would include things that didn't work. And for those that didn't work, it'd be good to try and understand why it didn't work and also be able to share that out with people, or so that people can also, you know, as your peers in other markets, can also avoid making similar mistakes down the line, or understand sort of like the potential pitfalls of a similar idea that they might be going after. So yeah, there's definitely no shame in sharing what didn't work. I think that the important thing is that people try and that they are given a safe space and encouraged to experiment and empowered to execute themselves. Like there should be hopefully no barrier between, you know, ideation and execution. And I think at the time, yeah, we really try to allow decision making to happen at the lowest kind of level possible, like so as close to the execution, you know, level as possible. And yeah, so there's definitely no shame in documenting what didn't work, and again measuring and keeping track of what you've done and continually trying, I think is really the most important part here.
I'm just asking because I know that a lot of people only want to share what worked, and sometimes that's nice, but sometimes it's also what didn't work, and especially if I know why, that helps to also avoid mistakes, which is super crucial to not make the same mistakes again. So therefore I just needed to ask it here, because it sounds like playbook is like the way to go, but figuring out the way to go can also mean knowing what not to go for. So just making sure that that's clear for people, that and if you have the feeling that you can reevaluate an experiment, then you can still do it, because if you think you have a different angle that might work, or you have new experiences, new knowledge, new anything, and now it could work, that doesn't mean you cannot challenge something that's in the playbooks. I think that was just a clarification.
Exactly. Yeah.
One thing that I also thought was interesting was the cadence of communication that you mentioned earlier. And I would love to dig deeper into how does cadence look in a 3-people team versus a 50-people team? Because for a lot of founders, it's super hard to understand the transitions, because it's also, there's no right or wrong, I would say. But from your experience, how did the 3-people team at Uber differ from the 50-people team at Uber or the 100-people team at Spot at Home?
Yeah, I'm gonna have to jog my memory a bit, but I remember at the three people with the three people team, you were communicating. We were communicating pretty much real time all the time because we're working around the same table. We're like sitting next to each other, like the entire day, all the time, and so we were mostly always up to date because we're working together on things. And we would deliberately take time out, once a week to go get lunch and over lunch have a bit more of a focused discussion about priorities and like strategy. But it was very informal and we didn't necessarily need like slides or decks or anything like that, as long as we were all looking at the same numbers and working off the same documents. So that was a three-person format. And then at a larger scale, I think with 50 people, it became there were sub-teams. And so I would still get everyone together once a week to share the top line of like the highlights of what was, what each team kind of delivered and did in terms of metrics. And so it's different, right? But the two 50 people or 60 people teams I led were one was in China where you're running a region. So there's multiple cities largely doing the same things, but in different places and different, maturity. So every team should have their own cadence, which was probably once a week, setting priorities, looking at the numbers, and trying things. And then as a collective group within the region, we would also just like, meet once a week, and then in person, maybe bonding like once a month or something, getting people physically together, to build sort of like the team, the culture. And then across those groups, there's also functional peers who may choose to meet up either once a week or biweekly to share tactics in the form of playbooks I talked about. Yeah, in a 200 or 100 person level, I remember we kept a company all hands, as a weekly thing. It's important for people to see how the company's doing. And it was also to, we usually would zoom in on a couple of key initiatives that happened, celebrate successes or learnings. And look at the business kind of from more 360 perspective, and then allow the team to ask questions, right? So that's an all hands sort of format. But then otherwise, there were many sub teams. So at the time, there were sales teams in every country. There was marketing, and there was customer support. And so each team would also have their own cadences, right? So you would put in place whatever makes sense for the teams. In sales, it might be a daily stand-up, right? Checking on the numbers, how people are doing, and versus, like the pipeline versus goals, et cetera. And sales ops would do their thing around, the commissions, et cetera. And then marketing was very different, right? You run experiments, you look at CACs or other metrics that were important during the week. So yeah, and I think when we looked at important initiatives at a company level, say you're a company of 100, 200, you're running cross-functional initiatives that were big things that needed to be delivered over the course of say a quarter. Sometimes 6 months. These cross-functional initiatives and the way you set them up are actually quite critical because often you definitely want the right people to be involved. So you want somebody, for example, if it's relevant, marketing, operations, product, legal, etc. You want them to be meeting and working together all the time. So that's for them, it's like a day-to-day working group that you've just set up. And they would sync up or report out things sort of every week as a working group. And then at the exec level, you should kind of make sure you're checking in and or unblocking things as needed at a fast enough cadence. So it could be either every 2 weeks, it's probably every 2 weeks or if sometimes even a week to make sure the most important initiatives are being looked at, and any issues are being addressed real time. And sometimes people do this more formally, like every month, like a big kind of check-in once a month versus every week. And you might just have the sponsor or the exec looking after the initiative check-in every week. But the key here is really thinking through who's got to be involved at what level, right? So the people who are working on the thing should be day-to-day working with each other anyway, with their Slack groups, with their email distros, whatever facilitates that. And then the check-ins with execs, I think it needs to be at a fast enough cadence where any learnings or mistakes can be corrected fast enough in order to not miss, your delivery window. But minimal enough to not be really burdensome for people in terms of like putting together reports and slides. So you still want to be super minimal and concise, and for meetings to be, as short as they can be, but allow enough time to go deep at the right frequency.
I think it's super helpful to get some insights on how it works. And of course, everybody has to find their own way of doing things. But even understanding how successful companies ran their cadence is super helpful. And therefore, my next question might seem like a super large like cut and switching topics, but we talked about the inside of organizations, and we talked about your role as an operator for a long time. And now you're on the other side, you're an investor now. So I would love to take the other perspective and ask more about how do you identify if the companies you want to invest in, and I know you're investing early, but have the potential for operational excellence. I think it's super hard to say in a pre-seed or seed startup, everything is set up for operational excellence. I think that would be a bit hard or harsh as well for this regarding the stage. But what are the indicators when you look at businesses and then also work with them along the way after the investment of that you're looking for when investing because of your operator background?
Yeah, like you say, usually when we invest at seed, and it ranges from pre-seed to Series A, right? It's usually still very early, and so the companies are small, and there isn't too much to look at in terms of like what's kind of in the data room or whatever. But usually, maybe you can tell from speaking with founders, like just thinking, like kind of how they think and how they work with each other, how they communicate with you, how they put together their documents, like are they structured, are they rigorous, are they prompt, like it gives you an indication on sort of how tight they are when they run things. And obviously it helps if the founder has worked somewhere where that has occurred before, like maybe the founder came from a company that was successful, right? A really reputable scale up or basically somewhere where they had seen this before. So that usually would be helpful. But I also don't want to over index on like second time founders or people who have a lot of operating experience somewhere else, because you might miss, you know, really talented folks who are coming from totally different backgrounds, which we should also be meeting, right? So it's hard to say. I mean, you can ask people how they operate, but in the early days, I think a lot of it is about how fast they learn. So it could be about asking them, hey, what was the founding story? And from the time you got the idea to where you are now, what have you learned? And you can assess their rate of learning, which I think is probably the most important thing, one of the most important things we would consider. Maybe they start off with a slightly different idea, but because they iterated, you know, fast, they got customer feedback very quickly, and more importantly, they listened to it, and then they iterated on it very quickly, and this is where, and that's how they got to where they are now, where they're raising a seed or Series A. We're like, okay, well, then if you kind of walk through that journey and listen to that story, you can get a sense for sort of are they curious, are they rigorous thinkers, are they customer centric, do they stay close, you know, are they really insightful about the problem space that they're going after, do they listen well, do they have a fast learning curve, and do they act on learnings quickly. I think those are really good early signs that, you know, a founding team is strong and that they can get to product market fit. And if they found it already, then they can continuously learn kind of how to adjust their operations and learn how to manage teams of bigger size, you know, accordingly, right? And then there's a question of like self-awareness as well, and EQ, because a lot of scaling and operating is about leading people. So there's a lot of hiring and there's a lot of coaching and managing people. And as the numbers get bigger, it becomes, you know, a bit more complex, but also the dependence on like soft skills also starts to matter a bit more. And so I think we would always look at founders and think, okay, like, are they self-aware? Are they able to sort of be vulnerable? You know, are they like good communicators? So that, you know, can we see them scaling as a leader? Like, are they, you know, would they be able to build followership in their teams? Because I think, yeah, like I said, the talent and culture piece is a really big part of operations. And like, do they even value culture, right? Do they value talent, or do they think people are just, you know, like resources that are hard to do a task versus, you know, being actually the most important asset in your business? Like, how do they think about it, right? That gives you an indication of whether or not they're going to devote enough energy to be good at it. Other than that, I think a lot of the other things, like operating systems, cadences, setting up, you know, OKR strike teams, all that stuff can be learned. And can be developed along the way. So again, it's probably not yet there at the seed stage, but that's totally normal as well.
Thank you so much for sharing. I have one, let's say, last important question. Let's say I'm a founder, I'm seed Series A, I want to strengthen my operations team, and I know I'm not the best person for operations. I need someone to assist me here. What are the qualities to look for in an amazing and incredible operations person? It can be a head of, it can be whatever. Let's put the titles aside and whatever I need, but what are the qualities to look for, and maybe a first indication of how to test these potential employees for these qualities?
Sure. Yeah, I think operations, again, it's quite a 360 kind of role. But if you're thinking about C to Series A at that stage, you're probably looking at somebody who can still roll their sleeves up and do things themselves and lead by example. And at that stage, I often think of like a head of or a director kind of level person who can be a player coach, right? So that means hopefully identifying someone who's had a fast learning curve and trajectory so far in their career, someone who is good at executing and is still unafraid and keen to execute. So this usually comes out in the interview process of, you know, do they empathize with the customer? Do they care about what the customer sees and the customer experience? Have they tried to go through that journey themselves, whether it's an onboarding funnel or whether it's, you know, buying something? And are they curious about the product and how it works and actually getting into the guts of things? So is there like appetite for that? And then we've often tested kind of talent and given them exercises to do. And it's a mix of left brain and right brain exercises. It's like, you know, give them a set of data. Can they make sense of it? You know, really just out of the analytical, because you do want an operations person to be, you know, data centric and data driven, right? Because again, that's how you get visibility into your business and iterate and learn. So are they analytical? Are they data driven? And then the right brain part is kind of, are they creative, right? I've asked people to do to do marketing stunts before, like sign up people. I mean, would they actually go and do it? Or do they think they're about the task, or are they just like unable to execute, right? So sometimes it's actually asking them to do real work that relates to the role that give you a sense. And then lastly, probably asking them about like how they would lead teams. Have they had to deal with people who, like underperformers on their team, for example? How do they handle that? And like, how do they describe themselves as leaders? How do they give feedback? How do they, basically you can get a sense for whether somebody not only has had some experience in doing so, but are thoughtful in doing so. And someone who cares about teams, and then ideally someone who can give you kind of a few concrete ideas and examples of what they think would work in your business, and actually be able to do it themselves, and then eventually, you know, coach team members and lead team members on doing them.
Yeah, I think that's super helpful, especially for, like, the topic overall is super interesting to me, as I'm just running a podcast and not running operations in a company, not leading a startup. So therefore, super helpful insights for me, and I think for a lot of founders out there who have not experienced a growth or scale up or any case of operational excellence over a longer period of time. So super, super thankful for all the insights that you've shared. Just wrapping up the interview, I will definitely link to your LinkedIn, to Stride VC. So if anybody's interested in knowing more about you and what you do, and also the VC activities that you're doing, everything will be found in the show notes. I have one last thing. So from my side, huge thank you. And with that, I would love to give you the last words of the interview, for things that you want to share with the audience and founders out there that they should think about, could think about, that are the learnings that you made over time, the things that you think are important right now. So thank you from my side, and I would love to hand over the last words of the podcast to you.
Amazing. Thank you. What would I say to founders out there? I think in this environment, in the end, I think it is all about the team and all about sort of the talent that you bring on board and the environment in which you allow kind of talent to help build the business and be part of the journey together. And in this environment, I think it's been very volatile for tech and for many companies, right? In the last year, and what we've been hearing is that the focus has really shifted from hiring lots of people to potentially some downsize. Of course, lots of downsizing has happened, but also retaining talent. And so, yeah, I would always definitely, especially in this time, encourage founders to really stay close to their teams. You know, be super close to kind of how whether they're engaged and how they're feeling, and ensure that people feel well supported and continuously motivated to be part of the mission. And that's maybe just top mind for me at the moment.
Totally understand that. Thank you so much for the podcast, Cleo.
Alright, thanks a lot, Fabian. This is fun.
Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Falls dir diese Folge gefallen hat, dann musst du auf jeden Fall mal den Unicorn Bakery WhatsApp-Newsletter auschecken. Dort bekommst du ein- bis zweimal die Woche von mir entweder eine persönliche Sprachnotiz oder eine Content-Empfehlung, Blogpost, Video etc. für Dinge, die du als Gründer unbedingt wissen, lesen, hören musst. Am einfachsten ist es, du klickst auf den Link in der Beschreibung und meldest dich an. Ansonsten kannst du auch auf jungunternehmerpodcast.com/newsletter gehen.